It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the industrial strategy and the role of graduates, asking if the student maintenance system is fit for purpose or sustainable. Spoiler alert, it's not. Plus, all the very latest verbiage on free speech. It's all coming up.
And it seems to me we end up in the worst of all worlds, where universities are incentivized to teach the things that have the highest returns, but at the same time, the things which the government are saying, things like their industrial strategy, are really important, are the least possible to teach. That would seem like a nightmare scenario for me.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to unbundle the HE policy conversation this week, we have three fantastic guests as always. In Bloomsbury, it's Julian Gravatt, Deputy Chief Executive at the Association of Colleges. Julian, your hire to the week, please.
On Tuesday, I went back to the place I used to work at, CityLit, 25 years ago. I was a very bad finance director. Lots of things I thought could go wrong, but actually they're flourishing, and that's just generally because of the excellent people working there. So it's always fun sometimes to go back to where you've made mistakes in the past.
And in Exeter, it's former Provost of University of Exeter and Director of Higher Futures, Janice Kay. Janice, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is actually something I read about in Wonky Influence on Tuesday, social licence. Everyone in Australian HE is talking about it, apparently, and I wondered actually what it was. Is it like social prescribing? Your GP will prescribe a course of costume technology or professional scuba diving for your health, or is it like policing by consent, teaching by consent? But in fact, it's the idea that Australian universities must have permission from their communities to operate, public trust, if you like. And some people are saying in Australia that universities are losing that. And I think this is deadly serious in the context of the US politics, in which universities have been described as the enemy. So I think it's translatable to here. So what are we thinking about in terms of attractive, valued higher education in our communities?
And in Liverpool, it's James Coe, Wonky's Associate Editor. James, your highlight of the week, please.
Hello, everyone. My highlight of the week is yet to happen. It's the excitement, the anticipation, a feeling that will be unfamiliar to Sunderland fans and the Tottenham part of North London. It is, of course, Newcastle United in the League Cup final this weekend.
But we'll start the week with industrial strategies and what the sector can do. James, talk us through it.
Thanks, Mark. Mark, do you remember your first industrial strategy? I think it's one of those moments where you remember where you were, usually.
When I came of age, it was just not in vogue at the time.
No, and you're right, they fell out of fashion basically through the 70s. Thatcher gets rid of industry, no point having an industrial strategy. 2008 financial crash happens and people turn around and say, hey, maybe we need an economy which isn't just selling people services and ideas to each other, so we should do some industries. The latest version of the industrial strategy focuses on some key areas like advanced manufacturing and life sciences and the creative industries, and UUK has released a report which says we need more graduates in order to power the industrial strategy because more graduates increases productivity. I'm entirely convinced by the argument that having more graduates is generally good for the economy because they use their increased labour productivity to make the economy bigger, people's lives get better. The bit I'm less convinced about is that we can definitively demonstrate that it is precisely the kinds and configurations of graduates that we have that are exactly pushing the UK's productivity forward. And I'm sceptical for two reasons. One is that since 2008, productivity has been broken or stuck, and we've had significantly more graduates. And secondly, if you look at the regional distribution of productivity in the UK, it also closely follows where there is more government and private investment, as well as having more graduates. So my big question in all of this is, I believe more graduates is good and important, but do we have the right configuration of graduates, not just more of them in the same places?
Right. Julian, do you share James's scepticism?
I think it's a really good report, actually, and I think it has makes some really interesting points about sort of sectors and regional things. But what James pins down is, I think one of the industrial strategies I remember is the Leach report, and that said that if you had a lot more people in education doing different levels, then everything would be better. And by 2020, I think the UK met most of its targets, but actually productivity had been static for 10 years. So there is definitely a cause and effect issue. But equally, you know, if we're going to make progress in some of those areas, I think UK are right that we're going to need the right people with the right right high-level skills.
And I think where you UK are absolutely right is we don't know the counterfactual of how much worse would things be had we not massively expanded higher education in this period. And the research that they cite by the government, supported by London Economics, does demonstrate actually if we hadn't had more graduates, we'd be even a bigger mess than we are now.
Janice, I mean, the prospect of lots more graduates at the same time also feels quite dim, doesn't it?
I think lots more graduates is really important, to be perfectly honest. I think this is a good report, and it's good to see that the graduate premier actually is still maintained in what UK are saying. To me, the issue isn't actually about the percentage of graduates we've got. I went and had a look at the percentage in the UK compared with other countries. The latest data I could find were fourth equal with Australia, with Canada top and Japan second and Korea third. But the issue for us is that we're still a low skills country. So we have far more people than Australia and Japan, for example, with lower skills. So the relatively unskilled workforce that we've got is the problem when you're trying to grow the economy. But perhaps that is another problem for another day.
I think there are two sides of the same coin, Janice. I couldn't agree more. And I think in some ways we've got stuck in this trap, right? Where if you look at the Work by Skills England that says which are the most demand professions, it includes things like care. Well, care is not generally seen as a graduate skill, but of course, because it's not paid properly, people's conditions aren't very good, people don't want to do it. On the other end, on the very, very high skilled jobs, the things that we know are going to make the difference in productivity, there's not the absorptive capacity in the economy to make the best use of graduates. So you end up in this weird sort of paradox where we need more graduates in order to make the economy bigger and better and stronger, but the economy can't absorb them, so therefore the economy won't get bigger, better and stronger. I feel like we're stuck, and I don't know how you break that necessarily.
I don't see it as just a graduates problem though, actually. I do think it is skills across the piece.
Yeah.
And the mismatch by region and the mismatch nationally. I mean, the kind of, you know, described as a chasm between the people in London, for example, who have got, you know, by 2035 approaching 71% with degrees, compared with 29% in Hull. I mean, those regional inequalities are going to be incredibly difficult in driving regional economies in these areas.
There's another thing, which is also that sectors are going to evolve and change, aren't there? I mean, take something like finance and professional services or business services. Perhaps the thing there is that with AI, there are actually going to be fewer people working in some areas in those sectors, but with better technology, because meanwhile, another of those sectors, which is identified as a growth sector, the digital sector, has maybe grown even more. So it's a pretty complicated, multifaceted situation.
And I think past that as well, as if you go further, Julian, and look at that sort of sub-regional analysis, you know, we were talking about the Northeast earlier. In reality, Newcastle and Darlington don't have loads in common other than the people tend to support the same football teams, right? But if you look at the overall potential for growth, somewhere like Darlington is looking like a really high growth potential area because it's got investment in life sciences. If you look at Northern Ireland with Derry City and Strabane, it's again looking like a really high growth area because of investment technologies, etc. So I suppose where I come to on this is it's not necessarily the graduates, albeit entirely agree, Janice, we need more of them, more education is a good thing. But are they allocated to the right places to make the most of their skills with the potentials they have to make the UK's economy stronger? And I think that's much, much harder to work out.
What do we think then about these eight growth driving sectors? Do we think they're the right ones? They are going to change and adapt, but they seem to me to be the things that a modern industrial society actually needs to focus on. And we need to focus, of course, on care, and we need to focus, of course, on health-related sectors. But these are the areas that are going to drive the economy. And by the way, they are areas that we can have some credibility in being quite good at.
I think that they're broadly the right sectors. But when I looked at a previous industrial strategy, automotive was identified as a sort of important sector, and that seems to have slightly slipped down, and interesting reasons why it hasn't. But broadly, they're right. And in terms of certainly our discussions of government, there's the eight growth sectors, but there's also health and care, which has got to have a massive growth in the workforce, but also construction is another one, which if the government's going to meet all its targets. And so both sectors are about a third of the workforce, the eight ones, and then there's other big ones. But in a sense, you do need, yeah, if you're going to get somebody to have the space and time to invest in life sciences, you don't want them to invent the next vaccine. You don't want them to be on an NHS waiting list because there aren't enough health staff.
No, I mean, I think they are self-evidently right, which in some sense is the challenge, because I think most people say, what's the UK good at? They come up with a similar list. And I think the debate that is yet to come is, what is the specific subsectors you choose between them, and how do you align graduate skills to them? So if I take advanced manufacturing, for example, are we saying we need more graduates who are really skilled in robotics and automation, or really skilled in nanotechnology? And they lead you down very different routes. I think the other big challenge is when I think about, you know, the role of arts and humanities and how society makes the world better. There is creative industries in there, but we should remember creative industries includes IT, which is a massive category within that. So, you know, I think it's the right things. I think the basis to come is, what don't you do instead? Because ultimately that is what the UK's workforce has suffered from. We choose to do everything and end up being stuck in this productivity trap.
And we have a shortage of people as well, in a way, to deal with the immigration restrictions, which I'd probably like to come.
Yeah.
I was, you know, and I know what you're saying about creative industries, actually including IT, but isn't it good to see that these are across strengths in graduate presence across almost all our regions in creative industries? I think that's good news.
Yes, I think it's really good news. And if you look, interestingly, at the in-demand occupations list by Skills England, some of the more in-demand creative industries are more like what we would think of the cultural sector, particularly around instruction in the creative performance, which gives me hope. I suppose my broader challenge is one of the criticisms universities frequently get is, oh, well, you're not producing graduates for the skills that the country needs. I don't know how useful the industrial strategy is as a guide to say, well, you were doing X, now we'll incentivize you to do Y because of that broadness. I think it's going to be in that needling of the debate.
But it's a blueprint, isn't it? It's a bit of a roadmap, or it's a clue. It's not unsubtle kind of trail of breadcrumbs, you know, choose your own metaphor. But it does lead surely universities to be able to say, well, you know, these are the areas where, you know, we're going to be able to demonstrate most impact when it comes to growth. And as a, you know, the corollary of that should be that we're able to get government and investments and other actors on side with this.
I think universities on the whole are actually very sensitive to workforce changes and in my and industrial changes. And in my region, for example, I think the universities there are thinking about the strengths there in terms of defence, and do our graduates align actually with the kinds of graduates that Babcock might need, and the exciting new gravity plant in terms of clean energy and batteries in Bridgewater. And that's something that is conceptualized not just in terms of graduateness, if you like, but also in terms of level 4 and level 5 skills and degree apprenticeships and higher technical qualifications. So I think universities are generally aware, but, you know, actually they have got to be much more agile in actually thinking about what the workforce and employers need. But I think that's not the biggest question. I think the biggest question is the way in which the relationship between employers, universities, further education colleges, the local skills improvement plans are actually brought in together and aligned.
I'd add the gravity plant in Bridgewater, which is for Britain's big bet on batteries and electric vehicles. There's also Bridgewater College around the corner with quite big higher education. And it's to sort of pull on Janice's point, there's something about the education system finding ways to work with big employers, but also working with the local kind of infrastructure, whether that's going to be mayors or other local actors as well.
I think the East Midlands mentioned in the UK report is another excellent example. When you look at, you know, nuclear relationships between Rolls-Royce, Derby, the Nottingham universities, plus the colleges there, I think where it becomes difficult to map the university education system onto things like the industrial strategy is the incentives don't align, because we know that the history of trying to keep universities solvent, particularly at the moment now, has been to teach a broad-based, relatively comprehensive curricula. And when that comes into challenge due to costs, the places where are the highest costs and therefore lead to thinking about changing courses or changing departments does not always align to the industrial strategy. So it does make you wonder that whether future higher education reform may see a greater link between industrial strategies, skills investment in universities, a bit like we're starting to see coming out of UKRI with the appointment of some of their challenge directors to try and move some of the research ecosystem closer to what's coming out the industrial strategy.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Rosie Bryce. I'm the Business Insight and Analytics Manager at the University of Salford. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about how universities can act as cheat codes in popular video and board games. Universities turn up more than you might expect in games. For example, in Stacklands, which is a simulated universe where everything is represented by cards, you can make a university by stacking four brick cards with one wizard card. And when the university is built, you can feed it 50 coin cards to get one idea card back. And this really made me think about how universities are included by game developers as a way of enhancing the world of the game for players. One of the ways universities act on game dynamics is to change the rules of the game, acting a bit like a cheat code for the player who can use the university. In my Wonky blog, I explore how we can use this in real life to start to hack the system we're in and maybe start changing the rules.
Now, on the site this week, we've been talking about maintenance and inequalities. Julian, I had to walk us through it.
No, I mean, there's some really interesting articles, mainly from Jim, about the student finance system. I mean, which effectively, I suppose I'd summarise that it was designed for another age, so from the 1980s and 1990s. And as a result, it's complex, leaves some students, a growing number of students in poverty. And there's a cross-government working, if you can call it that, with lots of different departments basically refusing to act. And basically, then there's a risk that the lifelong learning entitlement and reforms that will bring will sort of blow a hole into part of this. But yeah, it's a big and important topic, and it's really important for us sometimes to talk about students rather than institutions.
Mm, good. Right. There's lots here, isn't there, James? I mean, obviously space for a much wider conversation about this, which is, I guess, kind of what Jim's trying to start.
Yeah. And I don't know whether, I think Jim's right in his fundamental diagnosis and saying, look, inflation is absolutely wreaked havoc with the UK's economy. If you'd kept raising the thresholds of which you were expected to contribute to your child or dependent maintenance, we'd be closer to 34,000 than we are 25,000, which ultimately means that students are worse off. I think my challenge is that in some ways, the solution that you end up with is students need more money directed from government. There is no other route to doing that, because the alternative, of course, is we have the system now where effectively a plurality of students are part-time because they are in work. So even if you review it, the endscape is asking for more funding at a point where government funding is stretched. And I wonder the extent to which this is the need for a review or the need to make the case, and whether the argument is already quite self-apparent.
Well, I read the stuff that Jim has written, and Tony Morcester-Stimpson and Dave Phoenix, a deep sadness came over me, actually, you know, that was already there but is magnified by what's set out. And one of the things is, you know, Jim explains the history of maintenance support, but you know, the history is also the present. It's just the same monies that doesn't stretch, and I am extremely concerned about it.
A point I'd add is that you could write an even longer piece which covered how difficult it is to be young in our society, in a way, and so the people who don't go to university and may have wanted to but can't, and so there's actually a problem relating to versus costs of moving into adult life, particularly relating to rent and property prices, and also the sort of difficulties about getting sustainable work. And so in some ways it's an even bigger problem than described. And so I guess that perhaps one of the things to do is not just to look for ways to get more money into the system, but how to make it lower cost.
We all recognise that the sustainability of the UK's finances are hard, but the only way to make students live more sustainably or fairly is to give them more cash. And as we discussed in the last item, we know that part of the productivity solution is having more students, more graduates. I almost wonder if it's worth unbundling this, that there are some things which, in the technical ways that student maintenance is designed, are clearly unfair. So the way that your universal credit begins to rapidly taper off at the point where you start receiving student maintenance loans seems nonsensical, because effectively you are just moving one benefit to another. I think there is then a much different sort of moral question of are the amounts enough? And the choice we've made at the moment is to deliberately say you don't have enough to live on. And that is sort of the case. That seems entirely unsustainable to me as a system of which to choose different students.
There's also a coming issue, isn't there, with the LLE, the lifelong learning entitlement. Julian, can you just explain what the argument is about why the current maintenance system is going to cause such problems for that?
It's quite a difficult one to work through, isn't it? But I think the problem is that we already have quite an individualized funding system, in that effectively that students when they graduate, effectively fund it through repayments. And there's quite a lot of cross-subsidies go on around the place. The LLE is going to fragment the way in which student finance works, and so that there's a risk that it then becomes harder to have those cross-subsidies. I mean, there are other challenges with LLE as well, and in terms of, it's just a bit of a chicken and egg issue, but will we get the course development in order to, at the time when resources are really constrained, to provide the supply, but then to meet some demand, which isn't there at the moment. But yeah, it's tricky issues.
Mm. We're going to end up with this weird salami slicing, in so much as, in order to allocate the unit of cost, i.e. the tuition fee, to a little bit of a course, you can't just basically say, well, we're teaching half, so we'll give them half as much money, because that's just not how the level of subsidy works. So all that's going to happen is you're going to stretch programs out, but encourage people to teach programs which have a low cost base. And it seems to me you end up in a worst of all worlds, where universities are incentivized to teach the things that have the highest returns, but at the same time, the things which the government are saying, things like their industrial strategy, are really important, are the least possible to teach. That would seem like a nightmare scenario for me.
If the innovators in the system, and hopefully the sort of ethical and responsible innovators, find ways that are shorter, quicker, and sort of cost and sort of more cost effective, and get students from A to B, then perhaps that some of that unbundling will be helpful.
You know, lowering the cost base across modules, and you know, making it more difficult, there'll be more reluctance to deliver high cost science against what we've just been talking about in terms of the industrial strategy. But there are other ways of getting more money into the system. You have fewer universities and you have fewer students, and no one wants that, do they?
It is already hard for students to imagine where their money goes, and you then make that even more complicated by saying, well, a bit of your money sort of goes to this but doesn't really cover the cost, but by the time you take 10 students it might. That doesn't seem wonderfully easy to navigate either.
So it's Jim's argument about I'll have the barbecue sauce but not the pickles, you know, and that may seem entirely rational from a student perspective, and they'll have to have really clear guidance, but actually isn't rational at all to universities trying to maintain a rational curriculum.
Now, Free Speech Star Arif Ahmed has been saying a little bit more about his plans for that whole agenda. Janice, walk us through it, please.
So, Professor Ahmed, the new Freedom of Speech and Academic Freedom czar, has made an appearance after many months of not being seen. He's been across the media this week, and that suggests that the revisions to the Freedom of Speech Act may be on its way. Now, just a little thing about freedom of speech. You know, we all think we know this, but it is absolutely vitally important. It's our right to express opinions, ideas, and information without government censorship, restriction, or legal penalty. And we all know that freedom of speech is not absolute, and there are restrictions against hate speech, defamation, national security threats, and obscenity laws. But there are grey areas, as Johnny Depp and Amber Heard discovered in their court defamation battles. But the important point is that free speech is a fundamental principle in democratic societies, and it is often protected by constitutional legal frameworks such as the First Amendment to the US Constitution. And freedom of speech and academic freedom are basic principles of universities, and that's why we take our responsibility to promote them and protect them so seriously. But both freedom of speech and academic freedom are under threat everywhere, and I'm sure we'll talk about this. I mean, the issue in the UK about legislation that has just resurfaced is the fact that the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act received royal assent in May 2023, but it wasn't fully implemented. It was paused between governments, and it's now waiting for revision. And I think that's what we're going to see over the next few months.
That's right. So the changes that have kind of been briefed to the Freedom of Speech Act tend to be in a positive direction for as far as the sector is concerned, a bit less onerous and removing the legal torts, etc., that well documented on Wonky and on the show was going to be causing all sorts of headaches for universities and student unions. But I guess what can we read here in between the lines about Ahmed's kind of sort of overall philosophical approach to this. I mean, he says that universities need to show more backbone. How do you think the sector should respond to that?
I think it's I mean the bill was really bad, but we were left with stronger duties on institutions and stronger duty but a more restrained duty for OFS. And I think in some ways it's quite good we've moved to a situation now where the director of free speech is looking at what he can do in his role, so things like model codes and sort of checklists and helping people work through how to deal with the sort of issue. And I think all of us have got to work through how we deal with some of the issues that Janice has just listed.
Yeah, I think as we've said, what's likely to be included in the revised act actually looks good and sensible policy around codes of practice, that the OFS freedom of speech condition of registration and new complaints process. And I think it is interesting that Prof. Ahmed has actually wondered into how universities should be engaging with their students and indeed staff in debating academic freedom and freedom of speech and ways to do it. He talks about physical geography of classrooms, which I thought was quite interesting, but also around, you know, how to use things like Chatham House rules. It is a little bit senior common room, and it is something that universities are thinking about. But I think it is really very important that the crux of this with our students is how to disagree well, as Michael Spence once said, and really how to get to the grips where actually you can be offended. So I think that needs to be thought through. But the backbone point, I think, is around this naughty problem of academic freedom, which is really politicised because it's the unresolved issue around foreign investments in universities from potential bad actors. And you know, academics should be able to conduct research or to educate without undue interference. But, you know, there are concerns about foreign investments that can compromise. And lots of countries are preparing a plan to shield its universities from research. And, you know, Neil O'Brien yesterday, the shadow minister for schools, was calling for more transparency. So that's the kind of political point of debate at the moment. It's around threats from perceived bad actors, notably China and some Saudi states investing in our research and therefore thereby having undue influence on what we research and what we teach.
I mean, James, that's the thing that's caught the headlines, isn't it? This question of foreign interference. And that's also it's probably the bit that the government's going to be most concerned about. I'm sure they're incredibly worried about everyone having their say in, you know, debating societies, etc. But I think they're mostly worried about this from a kind of security and power influence, aren't they?
And I think the thing I find hard with this entire debate, Mark, is that the level of nuance and interest and description of which Janice lays out the case is entirely missing from the wider discourse on it. And we end up in this unbelievably ridiculous set of discussions about what our debating societies do on campus, whether it's important, so what is the acceptable level of it? And then you end up at the place saying, well, we'll issue some broad guidance, but ultimately it's universities that have to decide for themselves. And we basically go on and do this forever, because I don't think the government has the moral courage to say, actually, this issue has clearly been overblown for cultural and political reasons in the past. It is an issue, but not in the way it's discussed. The much more pressing issue, as you set out, Mark, is the fact that there is a genuine concern over interference in UK research with malign actors who have beliefs which are different to what the government's are. I'm far, far more concerned about that element than I am about students who are discovering the limits of acceptable sort of discourse in their places policed by the students. If it breaches into a crime or hate speech or breach the Equality Act, of course universities should act, but they're doing that anyway. I think where the universities need support is, how on earth do you navigate a difficult geo-political world in things like research and outreach, and how do you work with difficult partners, and what is the limitations of international collaboration, not what does the acceptable limit of offence look like, and what do commentators on Spike think? That is not the thing I'm concerned about.
So I think in terms of bad actors and safeguarding independence, you know, we do have this UK National Security and Investment Act, and in there is stuff around scrutiny about what universities are doing. So I think all that needs to be joined up. But I really am worried about what's happening in the States now. So, you know, in the same day, the president said that he had stopped all government censorship and brought back free speech in America. At the same time, he posted on on True Social that federal funding will cease for institutions that allow illegal protests, with students being expelled, imprisoned, deported if they cross the line. Line not defined, illegal not defined. So, you know, I do think this could be a growing issue over here that we have to watch. We have to guard against.
This is the political sleight of hand that we end up in, where defending free speech is seen as a sort of neutral, this is the sensibles who believe this. But the way in which that defence is executed is undoubtedly coming from a right-wing cultural point of view. Like, you see this over and over again, that there is not a sort of counter-debate in this. And, like, I entirely agree with you when I look at the National Security Investment Act and ATAS and export controls. But at the end, it is individual academics who are liable for following these rules. And I'm much, much more concerned about their ability to navigate them, for them to have support, to collaborate in good faith, even where people disagree with us. But I see much less public debate about what is the appropriate levels of support versus what is going on in students' unions. And the gravity of the two seem completely out of kilter to me.
The other issue is about the disinformation act of things. I mean, if you look at what most concerns college leaders, it's actually not, I mean, we have one or two debating societies in colleges, but it's more about how we tackle the sort of disinformation. And some of that can be linked to foreign governments and free speech, and some of the techniques that the OFS may be able to help on this, and other people may be able to help on that. But it's an ever present and important issue. My personal view is that the original act was mad. I mean, trying to regulate student unions and the sort of tort and all the rest. And it was, as James indicates, it was ramping up some of the some sort of things that had come from certain newspapers. But we're left with an act that has enhanced duties for institutions. But of course, as we've just discussed, it's a balanced picture, and it's how to facilitate freedom of speech while also avoiding harms.
I think one of the encouraging things, Janice, is that I much prefer the approach of, yes, we get this is complicated. Here's some charters, here's some guidance, here's some practical things that you might do, because there has never been a sort of theoretical argument that anybody saying free speech isn't important. The real tricky bit is actually, how do you practically defend that theory? And, you know, that is clearly a more useful place for the OFS to be in, for my money.
And so sometimes it would be better to act if things didn't always have to be in legislation, actually. I mean, the act wasn't necessarily necessary. It was more perhaps about how OFS worked through powers that already existed.
And, you know, it's that whole thing, Julian, of like, if you ramp up the jeopardy of all of this through legislation, through bills, through, you know, this political discourse, the only place you end up is actually making it harder to do anything, and ironically, chilling freedom of speech, because people want to do less. You want to take fewer risks because you don't want to get in trouble.
And on the issues you talked about, how universities manage research with the interest of foreign governments. I mean, some of that just generally needs working between leaders and government departments on a sort of non-legislative basis, doesn't it? Rather than passing laws which actually potentially make things worse.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in the UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Janice, Julian, James and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week live from The Secret Life of Students. Jim will be hosting. Until then, stay wonky.